Well, Charlie, thanks for taking time to talk to me about this new
Thank
book.
You.
I'm curious, because you have written one highly acclaimed biography of Kurt Cobain, what enticed you to tackle it? It's not exactly a biography, but it is, in a sense, an addendum to your other work.
Well, it is. And I kind of think of this book as where Heavier Than Heaven is really the story of Kurt Cobain's life. This is a biography of his creative life, which is different. And, you know, I'm a long writer. Heavier Than Heaven was 180,000 words, and the way it was published, the original version of that book was 300,000 words. So I cut a lot out to make that. So there were some parts of the story that I hadn't been able to tell and to fit into the parameters of what that could be. But the biggest frustration is that when you're writing a serious biography, you write a massive amount of words, you do tons of interviews, and then you're allowed 16 photographs. And they're all black and white. They can't be color, no matter how great the photographs are in color. And so then I'm looking at this man's life that stretched 27 years, and I have to pick 16 photographs that sort of capture visually what his life was like. And that was very frustrating. As I began working on Heavier Than Heaven, I knew Kurt was a visual artist and had done a lot of work. I knew that he wrote in diaries. I knew that he was very creative artistically. But I had no idea the extent of those things. And I kept interviewing people, and they kept saying, boy, Kurt did a lot of art. You ought to see that. And I said, oh, I've seen some of it. They said, you ought to see more. And what happened is that I, you know, eventually I realized that there was a significant body of work that a variety of people had. And I'd seen that. And then I started talking to Courtney Love. And it's important, I think, that people realize, because Heavier Than Heaven, when it came out, I'm not sure everyone understood that I wrote that biography completely independent of Courtney Love. She did not read my text and didn't like some of the things in the book. But there were a number of conversations that I had with her as I was working on that book. And there got to be a point where I knew as much about her dead husband as she did, or more. Because no one, when they marry someone, spends years researching their junior high school experience in their childhood. And so Courtney and I began a number of conversations where she would say something that Kurt said, and I would say, well, way, you know, his junior high buddy said this. And these became very long. Many of them literally were six-hour phone conversations. And in the course of one of those conversations, she said, if you really want to understand Kurt, you've got to read his diaries and look through his things. And I said, absolutely, I do. And she said, call somebody. And 2 weeks later, I flew down to Los Angeles, and I was left alone in a house with a duffel bag full of Kurt Cobain's diaries. It had quite literally not been opened since he had died. And there was a vast amount of material in there that I am absolutely sure Courtney Love or no one wanted me to see. It had not been pre-approved or filtered there, you know. But for a biographer, it was an absolute coup of all time to be able to see this material. And there was a lot of visual material in that. And that then began the conversation where I said, I want to see all this other visual material. That was stored separately in a separate vault.
You mentioned at the outset of this book that, you know, he was a collector, and everybody told you he was a collector. What we see in this book, in addition to your text, are both drawings and paintings, collages that he made, photographs of collections, and then photographs. So this is a story. The text is half of it. The pictures, the pictorial depiction, is a full half. It's not just 16 photographs. It's not just an illustration. It is the content, in a sense, or at least a significant portion.
It is. And as you said, not only did he create this art, he was a nut about collecting. And the funniest thing is that we talk about this now. We're in 2008. eBay has been around for 10, 12 years. Kurt collected all of this stuff in an era before eBay, and that's quite significant. There's a number of things in his quote-unquote personal collection that were quite valuable that would be very, very hard for a collector to find even today. But he methodically sought this material out. And in some of the things he collected, which was most notably anatomical models, he drove miles out of his way. He mail-ordered stuff. He had people in other cities track it down. He was obsessive about the things that he was obsessive about and bought hundreds of these items.
Well, how does that obsession, that penchant for collecting and the visual aspect of who he was maybe change how we who know him through music actually see this man?
Well, I've noticed this in writing about other musicians, having written a biography of Jimi Hendrix and written about a number of other musicians in my career. I think we have a tendency to think that the creative gene, whatever that is, only finds one output. You know, okay, I'm going to be a musician. And in almost everyone I've ever analyzed closely, that gene is not exclusive to the particular form they usually become famous for. And in the instance of Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, and Kurt Cobain, all of those individuals were very talented visually. And I think the same, you know, motivation to create that makes these people want to write songs also affects how they think of the world visually. And it's not like they cut one of those off. But we, because we know him for his music, we have a hard time even imagining this other aspect of his life.
But the visual art came first, you say.
It did. And that is what I found one of the more interesting aspects to chronicling his early life, is that when Kurt was a teenager in Aberdeen, he was known to everybody in that miscreant community of hang-ons to the band The Melvins as an artist, not as a musician. And there's one picture in this book that, it, you know, there's a number of pictures mm-hmm. that are just amazing. But there's one picture that just blows me away of Kurt at an easel when he's about 8 years old and he's got a comic book. It's Giant Werewolf Stories and he is copying that comic book. And I didn't see that picture until I began working on this book. But shockingly, when I was writing Heavier Than Heaven, I interviewed a kid that was in kindergarten and sat next to Kurt. And he told me the story then. He said, yeah, Kurt was just amazing. Once he just sat down and drew a werewolf for me, and it looked exactly like. And then you hear that story, and then I see a picture that's the proof that that story was true. And it really moved me in a way that I wasn't prepared for going into this project.
I want to go back to the duffel bags that you discovered, which were, anybody who's seen Heavier Than Heaven knows that the journals were also full of drawings and doodles, and it's hard to separate him out because he was a writer as well, and he had a very rich fictional sense of himself often. But so you get these duffel bags. They're journals, photographs. What actually was inside of them?
All of that and more. You know, everything from Kurt Cobain's tax returns to medical files to love notes to Courtney on little post-its to faded faxes to weird things he wrote on the back of envelopes. Kurt had an interesting approach to paper. He would write on the back of anything, envelopes. There's one picture in this book that's amazing where he decides to sort of write this poem on the back of a broken piece of a guitar. Anything that was flat became, you know, something that he felt was worth writing on. And that included and extended to the walls of his various apartments, which there are a few pictures in the book that are just pretty amazing. You get to see these walls. Now, I got a chance as working on my biography to see those apartments after Kurt had been there. And I couldn't see the infamous graffiti because it had now been painted over. But you go back and look and you go, no wonder he never got a damage deposit back, because he created on every surface in every apartment he ever was in.
You said Courtney gave you free access to this material. She wasn't looking over your shoulder. How much self-censoring did you as a biographer feel?
Well, I don't know if I felt a lot of self-censoring. You know, we're talking about a man here who wrote in his journals about his drug addiction, wrote about his suicidal thoughts, wrote about his tormented sense of his own sexuality growing up. And not only did he write in his journals about that, those themes are in his songs that he put on records and sold millions of copies to. And in all the interviews he did, everywhere from the New York Times to my magazine, The Rocket, he talked very openly about that material. this was not somebody that had a door and said, don't go there, don't talk mm-hmm. about my personal life. I mean, you know, you go to In Utero and the first line off his third album is Teenage Angst Has Paid Off Well. Here's somebody who is obviously very intelligent and very self-aware. So, you know, in some ways, there was nothing that I could write about that Kurt himself hadn't already written about or talked about. However, there were times, just as a plain human being and not a biographer, where I was holding a document that just blew me away, where I had an emotional response. There's very little I kept out of the book because of quote-unquote taste. This was a guy that wrote a lot about, you know, intestines and wanted to call his first band Fecal Matter. So if you like the band, you kind of have to accept that there's a little edginess to all this. At the same point, you know, there certainly were things that I touched or held that just blew me away. When I'm holding a page in Kurt's blood, he literally has cut himself and dripped blood on it, or glued on a doll, which he did many times, a tooth. And I don't know whose tooth it was. Was it his? Did he lose it? Did he find it from a dog? And then there are a number of dolls, porcelain dolls, that he has glued his own, I'm presuming, from the color and length, human hair onto the dolls. And this art was just amazing to behold. And much of that is pictured in this new book. You know, I will say there are a few things that just didn't make sense as part of the story, you know, one being Kurt's suicide note. And it's pictured on the internet, which is a shame. I'm not sure how that ever happened. It certainly never got out from someone like me. But nonetheless, the emotional response of holding that and seeing the actual note and how hard he pressed on the paper, I will have to say, is the most chilling moment in my career as a writer and maybe in my life as a human being. But that is best not put in this book, and it's best in some ways, I describe it in Heavier Than Heaven, but, you know, that's the darkness here, that in some ways I wanted this book to be more about the creativity and less about the darkness.
I think for me, and I don't know if this is 'cause I'm a woman or a mother, but I, among the most touching things in this book are photographs of baby Francis being very young, as a newborn, I'm thinking. And there are, I don't think I have seen that many photographs of Kurt's daughter in one publication.
Absolutely. And the vast majority of these photographs in this book have never been published anywhere. Mm-hmm. And what really surprised me was to see how many pictures Kurt himself took. Now, I knew he was a visual artist and a writer. I didn't know how interested he was in photography. And a significant number of the pictures in this book were taken by Kurt Cobain himself or by Courtney Love of Kurt and Francis, or a nanny, or, you know, he also loved Polaroid. I think about Kurt a lot and things that happen in the world, but, you know, Polaroid recently announced they're going out of business, and it made me sad for Kurt Cobain, who's been dead for more than a decade, because he loved Polaroids. He took a lot of Polaroids, and he didn't, as with anything, he didn't just leave the Polaroid alone. He would take a Q-tip, as many aspiring art students do, and manipulate the image while it was still wet. So there are a significant number of Polaroids from his own collection. And, you know, one of the pictures that really changed the way I thought about the book emotionally is there is a picture of Kurt sitting on a bed, and Frances is at the end of the bed, and Frances is in a playpen. And she, at that point, is probably, you know, a year old mm-hmm. at the most. And in the picture is Kurt's feet. And he has doctored Francis's hair by putting some kind of mousse or something in it in advance. And so he's doctored her hair. But what's amazing about that picture, and I guess, you know, about this book, is that you see his daughter from his perspective, not from an external photographer at backstage at a show.
Among the photographs that I actually found touching, in addition to pictures of Kurt and the baby as a baby and a toddler, were pictures of Courtney Love. And the prevailing wisdom about her is, you know, she was, you know, bad for Kurt, all that kind of stuff that's floating around. These are pictures that were taken with love, from my perspective.
Well, my job as a biographer, when I was working on Heavier Than Heaven and on this book, is not to tell the story from what a popular opinion poll thought of Kurt or Courtney or their relationship. It was to tell the story from what Kurt thought in his own diaries. And despite the public opinion on Courtney, what really, in some ways, I have to admit, even surprised me when I began to see so many of these notes that were back and forth between them. And they were very similar to MASH notes that I might have sent to a girl I was in love with when I was in my 20s. You know, they reflected this kind of young, innocent love. Now, admittedly, they were famous and rich, and drugs at times were involved in their life, and they were being investigated by the state social health services in LA, and that was a horrible thing for any family to go through. But what was clear from those notes and from these pictures is that they loved each other. Mm-hmm. This book, the pictures that you see are not pictures of two famous people and a kid. You see pictures of a family, and they look exactly like any other family with a 1 or 2 year old, except I don't remember putting mousse in my kid's hair and giving him a mohawk.
No.
Or ever painting the word diet girl on his stomach, which Kurt has done once for Francis in a photo here. But this is really a private, intimate look at a relationship, mm-hmm. at a family, and at what Kurt's private life was like. And that, I think, was why it was so moving.
Now, you chronicled Nirvana the band at the time that the band was actually playing. I mean, you were a music journalist for a lot of the, all the 90s, I think, or most of the early 90s.
The ones I was awake for, yeah.
Yeah, the ones you were awake for. And so I'm assuming that you come into this project from that perspective. But at this point in time, you've been researching, writing, studying this man, studying his music, studying his life for quite a few years. First of all, I want to know if that affects, you know, looking back to 1991 and 92 when this band was so huge, if that affects the way you hear the music that was so famous that changed the world, and B, if at some point in time you just need to put it all to bed.
Well, I think both things are true. When I listen to the music now, obviously I know the backstory. I admit I bootlegged a Nirvana concert, the 1992 concert when Nirvana played at Seattle Center Coliseum. I'm the only person, I think, who smuggled a tape recorder into that. And I never copied it, but somebody copied my tape from my house, and it's leaked out a few times. Not a very great copy of a tape. It was an amazing show. But if I go back and play that tape now, it has an entirely different context, knowing that Kurt hadn't seen his father for a decade prior to that, and his father had shown up at the show, that his mother was backstage, and that his father and his mother divorced for a long time, were fighting, that he was just recovering from drug addiction. These were all things I didn't know when I saw that show. And you listen to it now, and it has a different feel. It however makes the art better in some ways, and knowing the struggles that he went through and what really drove him, just give me a different perspective. I was just this morning watching a video, because I was describing a caption in this book. Kurt Cobain played one single solo show in his life, and that was in September of 1992, you know, at the height of his fame. He's kind of retreated from the world. He jumps on stage with Mudhoney and Sonic Youth at this outdoor place in California. And he gets on stage and plays a Lead Belly song, Where Did You Sleep Last Night, which later he would do on Unplugged. But I think it's maybe the first time he's ever played the song live. And when I now looked at that video this morning, knowing the whole story behind it, you know, and how obsessed he was with Lead Belly, it had a different feel than when I first heard that song, knowing that, you know, everything Kurt had gone through, that he sort of had overcome that. And I looked at it and I said, oh my God, this is such an amazing performance. Despite all the personal demons he was fighting, that he could put that much into the performance of a song. So despite in some ways being tired of Kurt Cobain to a degree, mm-hmm. for having written so much about him, what's interesting is that the quality of the art in the years I've chronicled the band, I first saw the band in the late 80s, 20 years ago now, I think the work is even better than I did when I first saw it.
Yeah, I'm thinking now of iconic musicians, iconic artists, and every generation has them. There are artists like the Beatles that are, you know, what they did transcends the time that they were doing it. There are people before Frank Sinatra, probably you could argue for a whole lot, Elvis, you know, people who made seminal changes. Nirvana was one of those bands. They were more than the sum of their parts in a sense. But for a whole, it's been almost, is it 15 years since Kurt Cobain?
15 years this next April.
Since Kurt Cobain died. So a whole generation of teenagers could come upon this music. You have learned so much more. The art is so much more valuable to you. Can it speak to this next generation?
Well, I think not only can it, I think it does. You know, Heavier Than Heaven came out, I don't know, what is it now, 8 years ago? And I get a couple of emails every day of my life from some kid somewhere who is responding to having read that book. And what's shocking is how worldwide it is. I mean, literally, I'll get an email from a kid in Brazil, which I did yesterday. It's a 13-year-old person. I think it's a girl. I don't know, because sometimes those Brazilian names. But, you know, I'm a 13-year-old from São Paulo, Brazil, and your book really touched me. I love Kurt Cobain. Thank you. You know, I get this stuff constantly, and I'm surprised to a degree at the lasting impact of the music. But it, in some ways, it doesn't surprise me, because the music that I grew up with and that moved me still has that same resonance for me. And I almost think of Kurt Cobain nowadays as not even almost a musical icon. It's almost like it's J.D. Salinger was when I was a kid. Every teenager goes through this phase, and they go through that phase where they need to discover the art mm-hmm. that came before them. And Nirvana seems to be one of those touchstones that people go to. You know, the thing that I'm honored by is that by having written this biography and taking, you know, writing very specifically about Kurt's drug addiction and talking about addiction in a non-shameful way, a lot of the emails are also about that. Mm-hmm. And that is moving to hear from 16-year-old kids who have been through rehab or who read the book and say, thank you for writing about this. No one in my family ever could talk about this, and you're giving me the context to be able to bring it up. So, you know, these issues that were in Kurt Cobain's life, be they drug addiction, be they suicidal thoughts, be they irritable bowel syndrome, these are, or depression, which is the most common, which is not talked about. These are epidemic in our society, and people don't want to discuss them. And if it takes me profiling a celebrity to get people to bring that debate out, to some degree, that's my the good karma I'm bringing to the life for people to be able to begin to talk about those issues, because they don't go away just because we don't talk about them.
Charlie, in all this, is there any image or images that you look at and you say, this says Kurt Cobain, this will really give my reader a great insight into who this man was?
Well, there are a couple of pictures that are really moving because they're in his apartment and you see all his stuff. And I begin the book talking about what his apartment was like. But to actually see the walls of the apartment and the walls of this Olympia apartment, the same apartment he wrote Smells Like Teen Spirit in, behind him is a Mikhail Gorbachev poster. There's a poster for The Visible Man. He's got a little tiny Beatles figurines that are glued to something behind him. There's a Butthole Surfers album down by his feet. You can see his world, and in some ways you can see all the things that eventually created the art. And for me, those images, the sort of private look into his world, tell so much more of the story of the music. And there's also a picture in the book that's a double-page spread, and I made them blow it up big. I said, if we're going to use this, it has to be huge. And it's just simply a picture of Kurt's cassettes, the cassettes that are still known to exist, of over 100 cassettes. And that is the sadness that I feel when I look at this book, because, one, I don't have copies of all that music. Two, when you see, their acoustic songs, their rehearsals, their other things that have yet to come out, and many of them probably never will, but it does remind you that the loss was also musical, that the great thing we lost as fans, the people that knew and loved Kurt lost him as a person, but just as fans, we also lost that music. But nonetheless, to see that treasure trove that still exists kind of reminded me, oh yeah, this is what it was all about in the first place.